You are listening to 99.1 WQRT LP Indianapolis, and this is Create Here. Produced by artists and curators from Big Car Collaborative, Create Here is your place to listen to conversations with people making intriguing, innovative, and impactful things happen on the cultural front in Indianapolis, Indiana, and beyond. Find out more and access additional episodes at WQRT.org.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of Create Here. Thank you to Oreo Jones, WQRT, and Big Car Collective for making this conversation possible. I'm Mary Goodwin of Aurora Photo Center, and we're here to talk today with artist Aaron R. Turner, who will discuss his new book, Moves from the Archive, among many other aspects of his multifaceted practice. Aaron currently lives and teaches in Arkansas. He received his MA from Ohio University and an MFA from Rutgers University. He was a 2018 Lightwork Artist in Residence, a 2019 Enfoco Photography Fellow, a 2020 Visual Studies Workshop Projects-Based Artist in Residence, a 2021 Creators Lab Photo Fund recipient, a 2022 Daryl Chappelle Foundation Photographer in Residence at Ogden Museum of Southern Art, and in 2023, he recently finished a two-week residency in the inaugural Plains Exchange Tulsa Artist Fellowship. Aaron has shown his work widely at major institutions, and his exhibition, Black Alchemy, Resolve Attempt Number 1, is currently on view at the Penumbra Foundation in New York City until September 30th. Check out his work online at aaronturner.studio. Welcome, Aaron. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Mary.
That's right. You're giving a talk about your work and your new book at New Fields this evening, July 11th at 7 p.m., and we're all looking forward to that, but we thought we'd chat a little bit beforehand.
Sure.
And I always love to start at the very beginning, and I know you were born in West Memphis, Arkansas, and I wonder, like, what was it like growing up there, and was there somebody in your family who was in the arts who got you interested in art and photography?
Yeah. Growing up in West Memphis, Arkansas, the Arkansas Delta, as some folks would call it, it was interesting. I grew up I talk with my older brother about this a lot of the times, and we are about 11 years apart. So he's known me my whole life from this very specific perspective of like coming into the world. And but the one thing we talk about when we talk about West Memphis is resilience and just that atmosphere of the Arkansas Delta and eastern Arkansas, right across the Mississippi River from Memphis, Tennessee. It's a lot of farming. People grow a lot of rice, a lot of soybeans, a lot of cotton, things of that nature. A lot of my family members, I remember growing up going to church out in the more rural parts outside of West Memphis, places like Marion, Arkansas, Crawfordsville, Arkansas, Earl, Arkansas. My great-grandmother, my extended family all lived in those areas, and we would see them, have gatherings, attend funerals, oral traditions passed down. My family has a lot of teachers, a lot of people who work for themselves. My grandfather, for example, a lot of people grew up farming. Both my grandparents did that on my mom's side and my dad's side, too. But that was over in Memphis. But yes, I basically, you know, was born and raised in West Memphis and ended up going to high school and college over in Memphis, Tennessee, but also frequented Mississippi a lot, too. So, you know, in that area is a tri-state area, northern Mississippi, West Tennessee, and Arkansas. They all just touch, and it's easy to get to one place from the next. Family members kind of stay in all the different places and stuff like that. And as a matter of fact, both sides of my family, I'm kind of getting in the weeds, but both sides of my family, my dad's side of the family derived from near Jackson, Mississippi, Utica and Brandon, Mississippi. Mm-hmm. And then my mother's side of the family kind of derives from Walls, Mississippi. And then they all migrate over into Helena, West Helena, and then through up through to West Memphis where they settled. And then, you know, my parents meet and here I am. Basically, is how I like to describe it to folks. But yeah, a lot of culture, a lot of food, a lot of music. West Memphis, Arkansas actually has like a small museum at the Mid-South Community College there that highlights a very specific radio station that was crucial in playing a lot of early blues music like Howlin' Wolf. And I don't know if Robert Johnson is one. I'm trying to get the dates correct on that. But a lot of blues musicians would stop through West Memphis and get their music on the air before branching out to these other places like Memphis and Chicago. And they were coming from places like Clarksdale, Mississippi, and things like that. So West Memphis has a lot of history.
And a lot of arts and culture, it sounds like.
Yeah. And so you did ask me about arts and culture.
What's your first memory of art or picking up a camera?
My first memory of art or just paying attention to things around me visually was the Sunday edition of the Commercial Appeal. And that was a local newspaper, which I interned for them about 2 years, interned and freelance for them about 2 years when I was going back and forth from Ohio University. But all I would do is look at the pictures. All I would do is look at the comics, or people call it the funnies. It's just a series of comic book strips or comic strips in the paper. They have all these different things you can read and all these different things they're doing in them. But I really loved looking at the pictures. And from then on, I would just look at a lot of magazines, and all I would do is flip through and I'd be drawn to the pictures. I really wasn't concerned about reading what was in them until much later in life. But yeah, I didn't grow up going to museums outside of the Civil Rights Museum, which was over in Memphis. Went to several school trips to that. Then we have another museum called the Pink Palace Museum. And then like any other place, there's a big children's museum and stuff like that. But I didn't get into things like MoMA or contemporary art or historical traditional art until much later when I got to Rutgers. So, yeah, I wouldn't say there's no artists in my family, at least that I am aware of.
It sounds like you were drawn to the visual.
Yeah, I was drawn to the visual early on, and I thought that I was going to be a journalist.
Yeah.
And be a photojournalist. Mm-hmm. And then I turned to art as I began to be exposed to more and more things, just living life. But yeah, I often think about, like, how did I get here? Because a lot of folks in my family, I guess they, like I mentioned earlier, a lot of people in my family, they are self-starters. Like my grandfather was, he used to work at the tax revenue office in Tyler, Texas. And he got to his like late 30s or mid 30s. And he was like, I'm tired of working for other people. I'm going to law school with a whole family. And he graduated from University of Memphis in the 70s, I think. One of the first African-American law students to graduate from University of Memphis. And so he did that. And then my other grandfather, you know, he drove trucks, worked at factories, all kind of stuff. A lot of his brothers went into the military and they became teachers afterwards. But he did not go into the military. And he was, you know, he was trying to find his way, and he ended up becoming basically what you would call a contractor. You know, he could build a house from the ground up, basically. He could do plumbing, he could be an electrician. He could pour the foundation. He did a lot of carpentry work. He could do metal work. So from just like a practical standpoint, maybe that was the artist. that I was just kind of seeing.
Well, a lot of those things do surface in your work.
Yeah.
No, and, you know, family is a really important part of one of your first major bodies of work. Yesterday, Once More, Family, the South is the title of it. And you say that you started that series in 2013, but it sounds like you've always been working on it, really, you know, because it has to do with family and being there in those small and important moments. And you shot the images that comprise that series in all the locations that you've just been talking about with your family, South Arkansas, Mississippi, and Tennessee. So it sounds like, you know, family has played a big role. Multiple generations of family have played a big role in the genesis of your artistic practice.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're making me think about teaching right now, because I think one of the things I'm always trying to emphasize to students is that themselves as an individual, like, you have a there's a very unique perspective you bring to the field of art, and it's your story, your original experiences. And yes, there'll be people that have parallels or similar experiences within that can speak broadly, but it's, I think making art is about tapping into your own experiences and sourcing from those, and then figuring out how to speak to a broader audience. Because you're, like I said, you're always going to find people who have parallels or similar experiences to yourself. But you got to start with that unique perspective. And so that's what I was doing with Yesterday Once More. It actually started, you know, I was at University of Memphis. I had changed my major two or three times. Landed on art and photography and journalism, kind of double majoring. Graduated with that. I couldn't find a mentor in photojournalism. University of Memphis didn't have photojournalism. So I went to Ohio University, and that was my first time living outside of that tri-state area, Memphis, Arkansas, and Arkansas, Tennessee, and Mississippi. And it was kind of a culture shock, but not like in an extreme way. It was just like, I just couldn't stop thinking about home. And I got to my second year at Ohio University, and we had this class in the first semester called Magazine, where you have to go to a place for 10 days in the middle of the semester, and you come back and you make a magazine publication. And so that's how Yesterday Once More started. And we had to gather all these sources, reach out to people, come up with a plan, have a shot list that we follow, what we were going to do over our 10 days and all this kind of stuff. And then the teacher approved it. The professor was Terry Eiler. And that was an experience I really enjoyed. And I, up until that point, I was really struggling photographing other people's stories. When I was freelancing, when I was trying to do class assignments, but it was something about when it came to photographing in a place where I was familiar to, it really just awakened kind of my creative instincts for the first time, and kind of developing my own vision in the way I see the world. And
that's where you needed to be.
Yeah, exactly. And another motivation behind that project, I could not find other African-American photographers documenting Arkansas at that time that I was aware of. But now I've since found three. But all I was aware of was Mike Disfarmer, Dorothea Lange, and Eugene Richards. That's all I was aware of about the state of Arkansas. And I saw a lot of people that looked like me being documented, but I couldn't find anyone that looked like me documenting in the Arkansas Delta. So, and in that project, it's very specific. I only document my own family, and I, it's about 90% of the images. And it's kind of about migration, like the different places they've migrated, Virginia, Texas, Missouri, different things like that. So it's, the origins are in Arkansas, but basically anytime I see my family, I just bring out the camera and I'm trying to look at people and see how my relationship to them has changed, how they have physically changed over time, what's new in their life, wisdom that I'm gaining from them. And we all come from the same place. So I'm just trying to kind of make pitches about that, those kind of thoughts. You know?
A lot of those same things come up in your next major series that you worked on starting on in 2015 when you were in grad school in Ohio, Isolated Truths. Mm-hmm. It's it documents the Underground Railroad stops and also the genealogical heritage of triracial mm-hmm. people in southeastern Ohio. So again, you know, talking about family, lineage, place, mm-hmm. and the yeah. intersection of all of those things. But this was, you started with your own story, and then you yeah. kind of took that storytelling, that way of documenting things, and looked at people outside your family.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been interested in genealogy basically since I was 5 or 6 years old. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking back to Christmases and Thanksgivings and just weekends where my dad would be doing family research, and my granddad, I didn't really know it until later, but he was driving around all around Mississippi trying to find court documents and finding relatives on what do you call those things? Like, he was finding his ancestors on the rolls of like inventories for slave ownership and stuff like that. And he was like, oh, okay, here's the first ancestor here. And then from her comes. And so he just wrote a book and he sent it to all the family. And so I'm kind of making my way through that slowly. So I've always had that genealogical awareness and kind of thinking about the ways that, like, why do people look the way that they look? Why do you get different shades and tones and in your family lineage and stuff like that? So I found this community of folks in Southeast Ohio. There were of like I was what I what happened when I got to Ohio. I was trying to find community, like I was saying earlier. It was kind of a culture shock, but I went there and I was like, I want to tell a story about a African American community that originates from Southeast Ohio. And this was what I kept coming across, the different triracial groups in that region, and I. Did interviews with all these individuals. I photographed them, and I kind of made this book for my thesis. I would love to publish it one day. It just needs a little bit more to it. But yeah, I talked to these folks, transcribed the interviews the old school way. I didn't really know about the pay transcribing services back then, but a friend of mine helped me transcribe a lot of those interviews by hand, and then that was the text for the book. Mm-hmm. But yeah, they were telling their stories in another way that this intersects in. So you got people who are comprised of African-American, white, and Native American heritage mm-hmm. in this area. And it all kind of correlates with how people pass through southeastern Ohio, crossing the Ohio River from places like Virginia, which is modern day West Virginia. You know, it all used to just be one big area, Virginia. And then you got places like Kentucky, people trying to escape slavery, passing through Ohio and then going on to Canada. But and then you also had the Native American groups who were marched across the United States through the Trail of Tears. And mm-hmm. so and then you had European settlers in Southeast Ohio. So all three of these groups just kind of naturally mixed amongst one another. And then you had stuff like Jim Crow and segregation, where people are coming out with, so a person may have a fair skin and to the point where they could pass for white. So this topic of passing mm-hmm. comes up. And I had remembered that conversation coming up in Nella Larson's books when I was in at University of Memphis in my African-American literature class. We read Passing and this other book, Quicksand. And then I'm thinking about films like The Imitation of Light. And it's all about this topic of being able to pass. And people had to make these decisions to do things like become doctors, get a higher paying job. And what I found out through interviewing the individuals in Southeast Ohio from these groups is that through some of the time, people would either choose to pass or not pass. And then in doing that, making that decision, I had several people tell me about instances where you like, you know, that's your family member crossing the street. But if you say hello to them or recognize them, then you're outing them as passing. People are going to know that they are actually black and not and that they're passing for white. So it was all these complex stories that I was coming across and trying to figure out how did this come about? How did it correlate to the Underground Railroad stops that are all along Southeast Ohio, and just where people are present day? And there's been stories by NPR about other different communities in Southeast Ohio and nearby and stuff like that. So I'm just one of many people kind of looking at that, and many other scholars kind of look at this research. But I was really just trying to figure out a way to collect everything and put it in one place through the individuals that I was meeting and just kind of get their perspective. And it was something that I kind of just stumbled on and kind of recognized the cultural signifiers through my own family lineage and just my own personal interests and stuff that I had experienced in college and books that I had read and stuff like that. And it all just kind of came together.
Major intersection point for and a turning point in your artistic practice. So it's like 2015, 2013, 2015, you're thinking about all these ideas of intersection of geography, history, culture, and this idea of passing and what it means. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, around the same time, there's a turn in how you're making images too. Mm-hmm. So like up until this point, it was kind of like, through the lens, photographing from life. Mm-hmm. And then in, somewhere in that time frame, all of these things are coalescing and abstraction enters the picture in a big way. And this is sort of the birth of your major series, Black Alchemy. Mm-hmm. So could you talk a little bit about getting to abstraction from, aesthetically from your previous work?
I'm trying to think of this. I kept making photographs through Black Alchemy, and actually what I did in Ohio kind of seamlessly kind of moves right into abstraction and Black Alchemy, this topic of passing. I found this 1952 Ebony magazine quiz, and the title of it was "Which is White, Which is Negro?" And so this whole topic of passing was, people would talk about it, and it was acknowledged. And
there were movies made about it, like movies, Imitation of Life.
Exactly. And so I just came across this quiz, and there was this grid of faces, and it was, like numerical or alphabetical notations toward it. And it was like, you had a little thing you could fill out of like, oh, I think A or B or D or E is white and not black or whatever. So that's literally what this quiz was asking. And it was in a grid. And I was like, let me take this grid of images. And what I did was I put them in Photoshop and I zoomed into like the pixelated grids. And that was kind of my first sort of attempt or interaction with like abstraction and trying to like decode or break down something, like take this factual history and try to put it in a format where we could look at it differently as an audience. Mm-hmm. And then also where abstraction comes in, I came across all these African-American artists making abstract work really in the early, the late 1950s, going through all through the 1960s, through the early 1970s or in the mid 1970s. But there was a lot of major exhibitions going around that time. And black artists were kind of under the pressure of coming out of the Harlem Renaissance and the Black Power movement or the Black Arts movement at the time of like, yes, your paintings and the work that you're making should express what we call now, what we would describe now as black joy. Like it should be nothing but positive imagery and it should be figurative. So you had all these African-American artists that were doing stuff maybe similar to like what people would describe as cubism or minimalism, geometric abstraction, post-minimalism, things like that. And they were being ignored by the mainstream art world, and then in some instances they were being rejected by their black peers. And so, and some of the things that were said to them was this correlation that I correlated it to, like, passing. People were considering abstract art to be white art. And if a black artist is making abstract art, then they must, the presumption is that they want to be white or perceived as a white artist. Or there's other things that have been brought up of, like, black artists making a statement, I just want to be recognized as an artist, not a black artist. So all that's kind of complex and breaking down, but that's kind of how Black Alchemy developed, kind of out of what I was doing with Isolated Truths in the communities in Southeast Ohio, people making choices during things like Jim Crow and segregation, and making specific life decisions for very specific reasons that had a lot of impact. And then coming across these African-American artists using abstract art and being perceived as passing as well. That was my interpretation of it. And so abstraction, passing, black geometric abstract artists is kind of the perspective that I've been working from. There's a whole lot of stuff to kind of fill in gaps there that I continue to research, but that's kind of the gist of, like, where I continue to work from in and out and around and trying to expand that thoughts on that and stuff like that. So
absolutely. You've been working on this series for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like there's still a lot left to explore. But I'd like to talk a little bit about materials in Black Alchemy. There are so many, there are recognizable materials. You know, I see paper, I see images, I see that have been torn in some cases. You know, there are mirrors, there is light play.
Mm-hmm.
So the recognizable materials, but together in the constructions and the way that you photograph them, they just go straight to an interior space.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the materials, about their physicality,
yeah,
and then how they lose that physicality and become,
yeah,
more and just become conceptual sculptures.
Yeah, it is about an interior space. It's an interior mental space, an interior conscious space, and a literal interior studio space that I'm working within, making these physical things and capturing them with a 4x5 view camera and developing the film afterwards. But that interior space is kind of like, it's a contemplation or a speculation on what the artist's role in the studio environment is. And that's a very broad kind of statement. But it's broad enough where I can fill it in with whatever I believe or deem. as the artist, I can contemplate, I can speculate within that loose framework, and it's a simple framework, a simple question to kind of answer for myself, or attempt to answer for myself. And that's what I do, and that's why I started with the mirrors, because again, I was thinking about home,
yeah,
and I was thinking about reflection, and I was like, well, just literal reflection. So that's why you see a lot of mirrors, mm-hmm, in my work, and then the way that mirrors interact with light. I've always paid attention to light, even before I picked up a camera. As a kid, I would walk around. I would always be drawn to, like, the light coming through the stained glass in church and how it would cover the pews or the floor with, like, all these abstract geometric shapes, language that I did not have at the time. And, you know, my dad was an architect, my brother's an architect, and walking around just the environment and seeing how the light comes through the kitchen in the morning, or going to my dad's office and seeing how the light comes through, and or walking outside, going to and from, commuting different places, always looking at the light. I've always been looking at that before I even picked up a camera, before I even thought about, mm-hmm, art. And that has just, it continues to be that way for me today. And so a lot of that stuff I was trying to replicate in the studio environment. So that's why I was using only use one light source. I'm either using a projector, or I'm projecting onto the objects and the constructions with the materials in the studio, or I'm using a continuous spotlight of some sort. It could be LED or hot light or whatever it is. As long as it's giving me that light source and casting the shadows and I can move it around and stuff like that, it doesn't really matter. Excuse me. Doesn't really matter what it is. I just want to point it at these objects that I've constructed,
mm-hmm,
and I want to see what happens. And a lot of the constructions, the materials like paper and fabric, like I can cut into it. I can develop my own like symbology or symbols in the studio. And that's kind of like a way for like a photographer to become a painter, or how I think about it. Cause clicking the shutter is like, it's not as intuitive as like taking a utility knife or a box cutter and cutting into something and then placing that, or breaking a mirror and placing that, or taking a random piece of wood and placing that. Like those are marks and gestures that are just not necessarily felt or captured in just clicking the shutter. So I've always kind of been desiring intuitive mark making in my practice. Excuse me. Sorry.
There we go. So the we can't continue until we acknowledge the fact that the compositions are just exquisitely beautiful too, you know, the tonality of your images and the way that light is handling and light is reflecting off of all the various materials. And it's a major component of the work and helps you stay with some pretty heavy topics that are addressed and referenced in the work. Mm-hmm. You know, there are many different cycles and phases of the Black Alchemy series, but I do notice that it seems like almost consistently throughout, we do see, you know, the surfacing of some important historical imagery. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of thinking maybe it goes back to that original grid from the magazine, you know, like mediation and the role of representation in photography. Yeah. So, you know, quite famous, the Frederick Douglass portrait surfaces quite a bit in the series. Mm-hmm. Multiple times. And I wondered if you could talk about that image.
Yeah.
Specifically, and its various iterations through different processes. Daguerreotype and
absolutely. I think those historical images like Martin Luther King or Malcolm X or Frederick Douglass comes from like a place of curiosity. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, how I would describe my practice is like I'm just putting stuff in front of the camera, lighting it in some way, and I'm just interested in how it looks. What's going to happen when I develop this thing? Did I meter where I was supposed to? Am I going to get the results that I'm hoping for? But when I found out Frederick Douglass was the most photographed person of the 19th century, I never learned that in any of my photo classes as an undergrad or any of my art history classes. And I'm like, why is that? And so that made me really obsessive about that image. And then to think about Frederick Douglass' intent of using photography, mm-hmm. and this attempt of using his likeness to change the perception of how African Americans were perceived, is like a big undertaking when the medium was so slow. Mm-hmm. I think it's only about 160 images. People estimate 160, 165 images. Now you compare that to the billions of images made per day. What does it take to, I'm thinking about things like, what does it take to be the most photographed person of this century? Mm-hmm. Compared to the 19th century. And then for Douglass, I think to recognize the power of photography, or like how he could use it, how he could manipulate it, for specific, intent or goal that he had in mind is like very telling to the kind of person that he was and his legacy and everything. So I want to continue to use his likeness to kind of continue portraying that idea, even though I'm up against all of this more advanced technology. So in that aspect, I'm thinking about history and technology and legacy. And I'm just trying to get people to sort of be more aware of that history and just kind of put that likeness, Douglass's likeness, in situations where we perceive it, where we can speculate and perceive it differently or experience it differently.
But you certainly invite to consider that in your current exhibition at Penumbra. There are how many different iterations of that portrait of Douglas, you know, in different processes. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the reinterpretation of an image like that over different processes, you know, like how is it about reminding people of the speed, the slowness, the commitment to focusing on representation that's represented in those like older, slower processes?
Yeah. It's about, you know, those older, slower processes are going back to that tangibility, that gesture, that mark making, because you have to hand coat the paper most times. Mm-hmm. You got to mix up the chemistry. You got all these trays of different chemicals. It's simple and complex at the same time. You got to make sure you got the right ratio. Some of it's room temperature, some of it's heated in these different processes. You can take a negative, place it on this light sensitive paper, take it outside, or you could use the exposure unit. So there's just different ways to kind of translate the image and process and everything like that. So it is specifically, it's more tactile, it's more hands on than just inserting a memory card or just inserting film into a film holder or taking a film canister and putting it in like a medium format analog camera or 35mm camera. So you're physically working with the material, and there's all these different steps nowadays where you have to translate it on the digital side. I got to do stuff in Photoshop. I have to change the density and the tonality based on the process, make these different filters to use, and then I make my transparency, and then I go back to the analog from mm-hmm. the digital. So I enjoy all of that stuff. And then the translation of the same image over and over and over is a conversation about it's a conversation about ownership in some ways, but it's also a nod to like what I think is photography's most powerful trait. I guess I probably could say that a little bit better, but just dissemination and repetition. Like I literally can take anything and repeat it in for an infinite amount of times that I would like to, and disseminate that out into the world as like this metal plate, this cotton print, this inkjet print, this transparency. I can print stuff on leaves and plant material.
Yeah, it's definitely a superpower that photography has. Right?
And we just, you know, there's advertisement, there's magazines, and it just all kind of gets lumped together at the end of the day. But I think artists have a special place where we can kind of start breaking down these things in our individual studio environments and share with a broader audience, you know, our interpretations of the medium and what's possible within it and stuff.
You've been investigating all of those questions with through Black Alchemy, the series, you know, for the past decade. Mm-hmm. And finally, in 2023, in May of this year, the publication of a book of this work. Mm-hmm. And it was published by Sleeper Studio.
Yep.
So I can imagine that you had just a vast wealth of imagery to choose from. And I wondered, how did you and the team at Sleeper approach making a selection of images for this book and sequencing and over such a long-term project?
Yeah, that was an interesting process because I was still making images to be considered and everything like that. So I just basically pulled every single image that I had made up to that point, put it in a folder, and handed it over to Ben Alperin, Ross Mansell, Peter Hoffman. And they played a major role in kind of keeping in contact with me as they dwindled through those images, dwindled them down to like the ones that are in the book. And I appreciate them for that. And I kind of see that as a collaboration because I was too close to the work. I knew that there were certain images that I wanted to appear in the book. And I did make some of those decisions because they would ask me, you know, is there anything missing that has to be in here? And they would figure out a place where to put it. But 90% of the time it was them in their own time, having conversations amongst themselves, what should be included, and then coming back and having a conversation about me. How does this feel? What do you think about this? And so I really embrace that kind of collaborative approach. Cause I just think I'm just too close to it and I would just include everything. That's why I like the publication format. It's a collaborative space and you can kind of step back from things and you can kind of be more involved in things. And it just depends. That's how I would describe my experience of that. But it was not as nerve wracking. Once I got everything in one place and handed it over to them, it was kind of smooth sailing from there. But we paced ourselves and took our time. It wasn't just overnight. It was over the course of almost a year and a half.
Oh, wow.
Just in that process alone, the whole book process in itself took almost either right at 3 years or 3.5 years or so. It feels like 4 almost sometime, but yeah, been working on this book probably since I think mid 2019. Yeah.
And I know that you got to work with another collaborator you really enjoy working with, John Mannion, who worked with on the separations for the book. And
yeah,
it is gorgeous. You know, the tonality and the imagery just looks stunning in the book.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, I don't know how to do separation, so. knowing someone like John to help out with something like that, and thinking about all the other artists' books that he helps with, and all the other artists that he collaborates with on printing, and can really make the images come alive and bring your intent and your vision of what you want things to look like, bring it into a reality. And it takes a specific minded person with that knowledge to kind of get to that place.
So, get to that beauty.
Appreciate collaboration.
Yeah. Well, so the book is out now and it is for sale on the Sleeper Studio website. So definitely go check that out if you don't already have your phone, have a copy. So it's an important moment for this long-term series, Black Alchemy. It's a marker of where you've been, but I understand that you are continuing to make work in that series and also another distinct series, I Won't Be Here, which you started in 2021.
Yeah.
So it feels like there is some affiliation visually and conceptually between I Won't Be Here and Black Alchemy.
Yes.
But you do consider them to be two separate series.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm still making things for Black Alchemy Volume 3. It's not finished. And the book is that first place, Moves from the Archive is the first place where Black Alchemy 1, 2, and 3 come together in the same space and not separate anymore, at least in that iteration of it. But I Won't Be Here is more representative of this kind of internal conflict or monologue. And I'm slowly, intentionally, purposely trying to touch as many alternative processes as possible. So everything from cyanotype, salt print, gum, bichromate, calliotypes, tintypes, just anything I can get my hand on. I want to kind of filter all that through my system. I didn't touch art process when I was an undergrad, and so it's nice now to kind of have the resources and time to kind of work through that at my own pace. And I don't really have a specific timeline on that one, but the title is kind of like reflective of like the person I was before touching all of that won't be here any longer. I'll be somewhere else. I'll be in a different mindset. That's kind of what that title is representative of. So, yeah.
It made I Won't Be Here made me think of the role of residency in your practice, because you have enjoyed a lot of really fantastic residency so far in your career. And I wondered if you could talk just a little bit about that, you know, some twists and turns, discoveries, and working in residency. What has that meant to you?
You know, I've always I've been in academia since 2008.
Good for you.
And now I'm a professor, but I haven't always been a professor. I've worked as a tech. I've worked as an adjunct. I've worked in other staff positions, but the academic calendar is so specific and you're not always able to keep regular studio time. So the strategy for me came to be is to at least do one residency a year. And that's what I've been thinking about at least the last 4 or 5 years. That's the way I've been thinking. Like, how can I get away and make a lot of work in this specific amount of time and then be able to kind of process it over the next year until the next residency kind of opportunity comes along? So that's the role that residencies play in my practice. It's very intentional of like working within the academic calendar. Mm-hmm. In a practical way, but it's also a space where like you get to go somewhere and see something different, mm-hmm. be in a different place. It's really good to kind of get away from like the stuff you have to do everyday life because it distracts you sometimes. It is meaningful to your practice, but it just kind of takes a while for all that stuff to kind of just filter through you and before it becomes meaningful. So to be able to pull out of that everyday routine and just go somewhere different and make and concentrate and be intentful, experiment, that's what the residency space represents for me and why I firmly believe in it and try to do one a year.
And you just got back from one. It's a new residency, the... it's in Tulsa. Mm-hmm. Looking for the name of it.
It's the Plains Exchange. Mm-hmm. And it is through one of the current Tulsa Art Fellows, the Tulsa Art Fellowship. So one of the current Tulsa Art Fellows is Shane Darwin. And I think Shane is in his third year of the program. And that at that point, they get to do external programming. So they get funding to do external programming. This Plains Exchange was one of his ideas to bring an artist from Northwest Arkansas in the Ozarks, which is me, and then bring another artist from Tulsa into the Ozarks and Northwest Arkansas. So it's an exchange. And so that was great to be a part of. It was 2 weeks. It was close by home. it was only 1 hour and 45 away. And I got to experiment on this other work that involves photography. It involves painting. It involves drawing. It involves sculpture. But it's all based in sort of ideas around how visual art relates to ideas about music and time. So I've been working through those ideas. And you can use the term musicology too, like how musicologists look at music and they try to break down things and interpret things like micro timing, micro rhythm, hip hop, jazz. And the individuals who are pioneering throughout history around those ideas. And I'm just trying to figure out, like, how do I translate that as a visual artist? One good example of that is the late artist, Terry Atkins. He would do these things called recitals within his practice, which were basically his performances. And he would make a lot of sculptures that relate to music and musical instruments and all this kind of stuff. But he has really amazing work. And he had this idea of like, how do you make, this is the way I'm going to put it. How do you make visual art almost like a musician would compose a song? How do you make it as potent as a song? The visual side of it. I think there's a drastic difference between visual art and musical art. But how do you merge the two together?
And that all comes together in this new series of work.
Yes.
I can't wait to see.
Yes.
You'll keep us posted on that.
So hopefully some opportunities come along down the road in the forms of residencies or exhibitions at some point. And in the meantime, I'm just going to make the work. So.
And also hopefully a new episode of your podcast.
Yes.
Photographers of Color. Mm-hmm. And how long have you been doing the podcast?
The podcast, I started that, had to be 2019. Did a lot of stuff leading up to the pandemic and through the pandemic. Then I've gotten to a point where a bunch of stuff in my own career was happening and in terms of my studio practice and like things like becoming a professor and stuff like that. So I've had to take a little hiatus from it because it's really just me doing it. Mm-hmm. And so I also kind of want to come at it from a different perspective, and I hope to get back to it soon. Sorry, I can't promise any dates, but I am intentionally thinking about it. I'm trying to be more intentional about it, and pairing it with some of the other things that I'm doing as more like a, what do I describe? Like when I'm curating and the artists that I'm working with, interviewing them, putting together catalogs or publications from specific ideas, and interviewing those individuals and letting those live as podcasts and stuff like that. So hopefully something like that takes shape moving forward. But I've had to adjust the last 2 years, and pretty much all I think about when I really kind of settle down is like talking to people, like how I'm talking to you right now. Like, I really enjoy this. So I just need to position myself, get to get back to doing that more frequently, and more intentionally. So, thank you for asking about that and bringing that up.
Well, thank you for this conversation today. I have learned so much about your practice and your work, and it's just been a joy. This is your first visit to Indianapolis, and mm-hmm. we will see you again here very soon.
Thank you, Mary. I enjoyed this.
Take care. Bye-bye.